It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up, we're taking your calls on the State of the Union Address. What did you think of President Obama's speech? Did you hear what you wanted, or do you wish the president had said something different, and why? And what did you think of the president's proposals to help the middle class? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. First, we're talking to a political science expert about the speech. Last night was exactly 6 years to the day from President Obama's inauguration in 2009. In this State of the Union address, the president emphasized economic progress and made the case that things are looking up for the United States.
America, for all that we have endured, for all the grit and hard work required to come back, for all the tasks that lie ahead, know this: the shadow of crisis has passed, and the State of the Union is strong.
Here to look closer at the State of the Union speech and its political implications, we have Joe Heim with us. He's a professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, what was your initial read on the president's speech?
Initially, I thought it was one of his best speeches. I thought of that at the very end of it, of course, because there were different parts of it which were better than others. But on balance, it didn't seem as much like a typical State of the Union address as it did almost an inaugural address. He had some parts in there for Democrats. He had a little bit, very little, frankly, for Republicans. Most of it, I think, was directed at the public in general. The last part, what I would call the values of the vision session, was really interesting. There was that part especially was vintage Obama.
Now, this is a unique situation for the president. It's the second half of the second term. He doesn't have re-election to look at. He's got the Congress he's going to get. So there's no real election implications for him personally of this. Does that in some ways free up a president in these last couple State of the Unions?
In a way, but keep in mind in the back of his mind is his legacy. So he started to, he seems to be at least the last, since November, building a legacy, accomplishments, things like that. I thought this speech was directed, at least the policy sections were directed more at Democrats and the Democratic base out there. The policy implications of that would be his legacy, but more importantly, it seemed to me he was trying to set the stage for the 2016 elections and essentially give the, call it marching orders for the Democrats, things that they can run on. And obviously, he's this isn't new that he's talked about the middle class, but I think he's focusing on the middle class and essentially trying to ask the Democrats, or suggest to the Democrats that they compare what the Democrats are, the middle-class party versus the other party, which, is the party of the elites or the party of the rich. So I thought there was a little bit element there of trying to set the stage for the next election go-around.
Now, talking about increasing the capital gains tax, something targeted toward the upper tier of the economy to help the middle class, policy-wise, that's probably something that Republicans in Congress aren't going to embrace. So on the policy side, this is a lot of stuff that isn't going to happen, is it?
Absolutely. The tax stuff is dead in the water, DOA, dead on arrival. And much of what the policy proposals are essentially dead on arrival. The child care, lowering taxes in the middle class, everybody would like that type of thing. Paid sick leave, maternity leave, equal pay. Many of these things have been done before. But essentially, those things to me to be directed at Democrats, and obviously they don't control the Democratic Party. During the speech, I was actually thinking, does he remember who's running the Congress these days? It didn't. I was expecting him either to be conciliatory towards the Republicans and look for areas that they could work with, or be confrontational. And in a sense, in some respects, the speech was neither. It wasn't directed very much at Republicans at all.
And that was some of the criticism from Republicans, that the president didn't seem to acknowledge the reality of those last congressional elections.
No, he really ignored it, frankly. Frankly, it was kind of amazing. I was expecting a slightly different kind of a speech. I enjoyed the speech. I thought it was really well done. But ultimately, it didn't seem to do much with the Republicans, and it remains to be seen just how well he's going to be able to work with them. I do think there's areas of agreement that are possible, but not much of the what I'll call the Democratic agenda is not things that are likely going to pass. And frankly, the tax proposals, maybe that sells well to say that, we want a dollar here, but we're going to collect a dollar there. In other words, instead of simply saying you're trying to add to the deficit, you're going to collect taxes. I think there was roughly $320 billion in new taxes in there. Well, that's not going to go through this Congress at all. I think everybody knows that.
Well, President Obama hit the theme of a recovering economy really hard in last night's speech. Let's take a brief listen.
At this moment, with a growing economy, shrinking deficits, bustling industry, booming energy production, we have risen from recession freer to write our own future than any other nation on earth. It's now up to us to choose who we want to be over the next 15 years and for decades to come.
So as we've talked about on the show today, this is a speech in the context of an economic improvement that we hadn't seen in earlier State of the Union speeches from the president. He trumpeted this economic progress quite a bit. How do you think that was received politically?
I think that was received very well because I think it's basically pretty accurate. You know, if you look at the last 6 years, we've had a very steady period of increase decreases in unemployment, slow growth in the GNP. You know, periodically people say, yes, but we need to do more. But the reality is things have gotten very slowly better over the last 6 years, and you have to say that the president certainly has a right to take credit for that. He has been criticized by Republicans for years that his economic policies are failures. And frankly, a lot of the polls seem to kind of agree with that. But at this point, you look back and say, well, after 6 years, we're in pretty good shape. I think he wisely took credit for that.
This is something I always wonder with governors getting credit or blame for state economies that are largely sometimes out of their control. Can a president really take that much credit, or is this just an upward cycle after a big downturn that probably would have been happening more or less no matter who was in the White House?
Probably more of the latter. He certainly could take credit for the stimulus and some of the spending that was going on, but frankly, a lot of that was reined in. But ultimately, you take credit for what's going on in front of you. You know, the low interest rates probably are the single most important factor in terms of the economy. But generally, this is just a normal recovery. It just has taken longer because the Great Recession was worse than most.
Does the improving economy free up Congress and the president when it comes to tax and spending policy? They've got maybe a little more wiggle room than they had when the economy was in dire straits.
Yeah. One of the things you did not hear last night mentioned by the president was the national debt. In fact, even the Republican response mentioned it very briefly. But ultimately, the debt seems to be kind of like a lost issue. And therefore, taxing and spending can be discussed at least. Now, the fact is, however, I don't think Republicans are going to go with increased taxes. And they're going to be very leery about increased spending. But all that said, I do think the Republicans want to look, going into the 2016 election cycle, they want to look like they can govern. And that may require just not saying no to everything. So there's at least a possibility of some compromises here, both in the tax area, particularly tax reform, but also in the spending area, at least in terms of the tax credits. There's some of the tax credit proposals that the president said were, in fact, approved by presidents in the past and, frankly, approved by Republicans in the past.
Do you see, outside of the direct budgetary issues, do you see other room for common ground between the president and the Republican Congress?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Are there other policy areas where they might be able to work together and get something passed?
Well, I do think that the tax reform issue, both sides seem to agree that there's corporate tax changes for corporate taxes seem to be in order. The things that I thought were are still very possible, cyber protection, for example, that's more of a policy area. It's not so much a spending area, but I think both sides clearly feel that there's a need for that. I think, in general, infrastructure is one of the things that is not a partisan issue that I think the Republicans could agree on. I'm not sure about the spending or where the money would come from for it, but basically I think that's an area as well. Last but not least, the area that clearly is most likely is the trade issue, both specific trans-Pacific trade and the European trade agreements. I think Republicans are more in favor of that than the Democrats, so the president could make a deal with them on this.
I wanted to get into a couple other issues that the president was talking about over the last week and in the State of the Union. He has this proposal to try to lower the cost of community college to zero, free community college, at least for eligible students. Is that something that you think might be able to get approved by Congress?
I'd say relatively unlikely. I think it was initially very well received. It's clearly a middle class type of a proposal, and it goes along with his theme, you know, the general theme of the middle class pitch that he's proponing here. But I don't think I've seen some editorials in the last week or two that actually criticized it, suggesting that why should you provide low cost or no cost education to people who can already afford it? In other words, suggesting perhaps that it should be means tested. And that frankly surprised me, because I thought the initial reaction to the community college zero cost would be very positively received. I still think it can be, but ultimately it's a cost factor, and this is where the Republicans probably are going to bucket it, suggest that the money's just simply not there.
The president also promoting the idea of requiring a certain amount of paid sick leave for all American workers. And this is one where he said even if Congress doesn't pass, as he was encouraging states or even city governments to take the lead. So is this a place where a bully pulpit, even if Congress doesn't agree, might make some changes at the local level?
I think this was another one of those examples where it's very popular type of a thing that almost anybody listening to that would say, you know, that seems logical. Maternity leave or paid sick leave. I mean, that's many, you know, huge numbers of Americans have that already. So the bully pulpit, to the degree that he can do that, he's never been particularly good at that, by the way. He seems to, does not sell his ideas as well as perhaps previous presidents have, but essentially that's one of the areas that he could do. Frankly, I'd like to see him get out on the road and try to sell some of this stuff.
Well, he, I think, went to Idaho, pitching some of these, his first trip, I understand, as president anyway, to Idaho. Looking over the next 2 years, based on what you've seen in this State of the Union speech, what do you think President Obama's presidency will wrap up like? What are you looking for in the next couple of years?
Well, because I think the Republicans are interested in looking like they're willing to govern, I think some of this is actually going to happen. It may, in fact, surprise us all that more will happen than expected. But frankly, I don't expect a lot, but at least some things. But the president is moving towards a, you know, his lame duck status. I think he wants to try to, and I thought his speech was particularly well done because he was trying to say, look, I'm relevant. And that worked, frankly. But I think, unfortunately, given the state of affairs and given the Congress, he's simply not going to get much of his policy agenda done.
Joe, thanks a lot for taking the time with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Joe Heim, professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. He was with us to analyze President Obama's State of the Union speech last night. We're taking your calls on President Obama's State of the Union speech last night. What do you think about what the president had to say? Did he go far enough or too far in his proposals aimed at helping the middle class? What did you like? What didn't you like about the speech? What do you wish was there that wasn't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll start things off with Mary in Platteville. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Actually, your previous guest, Dr. Heim, mentioned that he thought Obama was unaware of the victories of the Republican Party at the last election. And I actually am in disagreement with that. I think the president is very aware of the elections and felt that his middle-class policy is painting a very clear picture that when the middle class goes to vote in the next election, that they'll understand the only thing standing between the middle class and the middle class opportunities to improve themselves is the Republican Party. And I think he's passively, aggressively setting up the next decisions for the next presidential campaign.
And so do you think that was intentional by the president? He's focused on 2016 more than 2015 right now?
I absolutely think that's what he's thinking. And when the Republicans were celebrating their midterm victories, congratulating and high-fiving each other in the corner, I think Mr. Obama was painting the floor. They've painted themselves into a corner. If they vote to support his agendas, they're voting against their ideologies. If they vote for his agendas, I'm sorry, I've gotten kind of confused. If they don't vote for his policies, they're holding totally in the line, and no one's going to like that in the middle class. So I think they really have a tight line to walk here.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your thoughts. We'll go now to Mark with us in Oshkosh. Mark, hi.
Hi. I totally agree with the last caller. I think he gave a huge gift to all the Democrats running in the next election. At a time where Republicans have garnered the language and co-opted the middle class with policies that don't benefit them, he basically laid out an agenda that almost any Democrat locally, at a statewide basis, or especially nationally, can run on and run on a positive message of middle class change and middle class economics that has been missing for a very long time.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. We're getting your responses to last night's State of the Union address, where you agree, where you disagree with the president. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can share your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page. Ivy is with us next in Evansville. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. The last two callers said exactly my sentiments, and I was really glad that he brought those things up because it really just shows people how the Republican Party is not, in this time in history, for the common person. I mean, how could you not stand up and applaud when somebody says, let's work for sick leave for everybody, let's work for maternity care? I mean, all those things benefit society overall and come back to each and every one of us, whether or not we directly benefit from them. How could you not feel that those things are important? And it's my grandfather was a Republican, and my whole family was, and their 1940s platform was for equal pay for women and parks and, you know, for labor, and they're so different now.
Ivy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Rocky in Nishkoro is with us now. Rocky, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think Mr. Obama is heading in the right direction. He just spent 6 years cutting down the middle class, and I think he needs to turn around and help the middle class. You can blame it all on Republicans, but I know the first 2 years he was in office, it was all Democratic, so they were responsible as well as everybody else for cutting down the middle class. What he has offered is probably just a big leap for the Republican Party, so hopefully they can work together and help the middle class.
Rocky, thanks for that call. Still a couple minutes for your thoughts on the president's State of the Union address last night. What didn't you like about it? 800-642-1234 is the number. Still room, of course, always at the Central Time Facebook page. Sean is with us now in Milwaukee. Sean, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I think that the president put forth an agenda that really puts the middle class first. And during the entire time, one could listen and think, only imagine what the Republican response would be. All I could come up with is they could only say no to these things. They don't have an agenda of their own. So I was really happy to see the president put forward these ideas.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot for the call. Again, 800-642-1234 is the number, or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page as we continue our conversation about the president's State of the Union address. 800-642-1234, where Cynthia joins us in Sheboygan. Cynthia, hi.
Hi. I feel it's about time that somebody's looking out for the middle class. The Republicans and the Democrats are not looking out for us. They're always looking for the rich, and the middle class always stays poor, and nobody's looking out for us, and I think that's terrible. And I think it's about time that somebody steps up to the plate and looks out for us.
All right, Cynthia, thanks a lot for the call. You can follow all of our coverage on the State of the Union address. We've had conversations from the Joy Cardine Show until now. You can listen back to them over at WPR.org. Check out the audio archived there. Jeanette is with us now in Warren, Illinois. Jeanette, hi.
Hi there. I'd just like to say the idea of some sick leave would be great because my summer job includes sick leave. but my winter job does not. And you have people coming into work who are very, very ill because you're told that if you miss any of the days during peak season, you don't get your Christmas bonus. And so then whoever is sick tends to spread it to everyone else.
Jeanette, thanks a lot. Gotcha, Jeanette.
Yeah, you don't really have.
Thanks a lot for your call, and thanks to all of you for your calls. And you can keep this conversation going at the Central Time Facebook page or Twitter at Central Time WPR. Head over to our Central Time Facebook page. Answer the question, what do you think of President Obama's State of the Union address? This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickard, is off today. Coming up, we'll find out if we have a right to be mad when sick colleagues come into work. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Love it or hate it, winter is unavoidable in Wisconsin. Commentator Wendy Lutzky learned to embrace the season and urges the rest of us to do the same.
The dictionary defines the four-letter word snow as solid precipitation in the form of white or translucent ice crystals of various shapes. People living in Vilas County, home of the Snowmobile World Headquarters, might equate snow with the four-letter words good or cash, since their winter economy depends on it. Of course, not everyone always feels that way about it. My relationship with snow started several years ago when my husband Steve decided to build a cabin on our 20 acres of hunting land in Vilas County. As Steve and his brother Bill measured space for a building site, I challenged myself to walk the perimeter of our newly purchased land in February. What was I thinking? Not far along into my plunge, certainly not a walk, I found myself repeatedly sinking thigh deep in unending drifts of the white torture. Too proud to be defeated, I eventually made it all the way around. Maybe good was not the four-letter word for snow that day. Since then, Snow and I have become acquaintances, good friends, and sometimes competitors. My journal entries over the years attest to our growing relationship. Snow often gives away secrets. One March morning, we found brown pine needles and tiny pine cones splayed over the surface of the snow like confetti left over from the woodland creature's big bash. Another time, we followed the perfect tracks of a grouse until we found its takeoff point. Delicate wing indentations spread across the snow until the moment before it left the ground. Hundreds of animal tracks, deer, turkey, squirrel, the elusive snowshoe hare, and whoa, is that a bear print? They remind us that no matter how quiet the winter woods are, we are never alone. The wonder of winter snow in Vilas County is sometimes humbling. During my first cold, snowy deer hunting venture, I felt like an intruder transported into a silent black and white film. I entered the woods just before dawn. That, combined with the gray skies and black trees, completely surrounded my tiny island of blaze orange. I felt appropriately small and insignificant. Four-letter words are often associated with the profane. But during the crisp, clear days from December through February, I truly enjoy snow's unblemished beauty. It's then I know that my four-letter equivalent for snow is L-O-V-E.
Wendy Lutzky is a writer and museum educator at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more info, check out wisconsinlife.org. Well, it's cold and flu season here in Wisconsin. While everybody's doing their best to try and not come down with a bug, it'd be hard not to get irritated when our sick colleagues come into the office, spread their germs around instead of staying home. At least that's what we tell ourselves, that we don't want to get sick. But do we really up our odds of coming down with something when that sick colleague comes into work? And what's driving our culture when we feel like we have to come in, even when we're under the weather? Daniel Engber writes about the issue in the New York Times. He's a science journalist and a contributing editor at both Popular Science and Slate. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So in winter, we are all trying to not get sick. So what do you see as the typical response when somebody comes into the workplace when they're clearly sick and showing those symptoms?
Well, I think the typical response is frustration, fear, and anger.
Yeah, but on the other hand, sometimes is there a worry that if we don't come in sick, people are going to be mad at us because we're slacking and not getting our work done?
Well, right. That's the tension. I mean, we feel like if we're the ones who are feeling a little under the weather, we feel like, oh, we can't just take it easy and stay home while our colleagues are working. We better get in there and do our part. And then, of course, if we're the other people in the office, we're frustrated because that sick person is putting us at risk, we think.
So how does that square with our notions of our own human decency? Are we empathizing with that sick person? Or are we just looking out for number one, hoping we don't get the germ?
Well, that's the thing that was sort of bothered me when I started thinking about this. I've worked at an office for many years and noticed just the level of negativity and anger and frustration, and it just seemed like, where's the empathy? You know, this is a person who is sitting at their desk sniffling with a fever. Shouldn't we feel bad for them before we start feeling mad at them?
Yeah, the way we react sometimes is almost more like they've come down with zombieism, you know, that that we're in one of those movies that we've got to keep ourselves away from the zombie plague. But it's just a cold.
Well, I think part of what's so frustrating about it is it seems like the person is just, you know, trying so hard to make a good impression, trying so hard to, you know, get some extra credit for himself or herself by working, even though he's sick, that, you know, that person is sort of putting us at risk. So we have the sense, I think, that the sick person who's coming into work is somehow being selfish while you know, acting like a martyr.
Well, what do we know about the science here? Does staying home or coming in really make that much of a difference for risk for the coworkers?
Well, look, I mean, if you really want to avoid getting the flu, you can lock yourself in your house and never talk to anyone. I mean, that will prevent you from getting the flu. So it is true that the more contact you have with people in the world, the more likely you are to get sick. But the question is, how much risk is really posed by, you know, your colleagues at the office versus any of the other ways in which you come into contact with people throughout the day, on the way to work, while shopping, and so forth. And that's where I think the evidence doesn't really suggest that offices are a particularly dangerous place. That's not to say there's no chance of getting sick in the office, but I just don't think that it's a particularly contagious location.
So some scientists have tried to crack this, and you write about a fairly well-known study, I guess, where a tracer germ, a tracer virus, does seem to get all over everybody.
Well, there's this microbiologist named Charles Gerba at the University of Arizona, and he loves doing these sort of gross-out studies where he'll check to see, you know, he'll take swabs from all sorts of surfaces in your home or in your workplace and say, oh, it's covered with germs. So he did one where he put a tracer virus on the front door handle of an office building, of a small office building. And then 4 hours later, he checked to see how far that virus had dispersed through the office. And the results are really distressing, except that this is really just, you know, a model experiment. It doesn't actually tell you how many people got sick. I mean, no one got sick. It was just an inert virus. But how many people would get sick in the analogous real-world situation?
Right. Just being exposed to a virus doesn't mean we're going to come down with that illness necessarily.
Sure. Yeah. And there really is not a lot known about the relationship between, you know, the presence of germs on tabletops, for example, and the actual rate of transmission. What we know about influenza, for example, is that it's mostly transmitted by kids, or kids are a major vector, let's say. So, for example, when school is when kids are home from school, transmission of influenza goes way down, and then new cases spike again when kids go back to school. Also, you get a high transmission of these sorts of diseases in places like hospitals, in nursing homes, in places where there's a lot of intimate contact between people, and bodily fluids are here and there.
See, I've referred to my children in many positive ways, but also as germ bait, especially in their earlier years. So, is there a better case to be made for keeping kids from going into school versus keeping the grown-ups from going to work when sick?
I don't want to tell parents to keep their kids home from school. I think there are some things that we can do. We can wash our hands. We can instruct children in good hand washing practice. That'll reduce the incidence of colds and influenza. But I think, again, my point in the piece I wrote for The Times was really about this sort of culture in the office where we get so angry at people who show up possibly sick.
Now, I will say during this conversation, the hand sanitizer has come out. Our board operator instinctively reached for it. Is that just sort of a ritualistic thing we do in the office when we fear contagion from our coworkers? Does it help with viruses even?
I think that hand sanitizers and hand washing are helpful. I mean, Professor Gerben himself told me that the average adult gets something like 2 colds per year, but if you're washing your hands regularly, you can cut it down to 1. Don't quote me on those stats. This is my recollection of the numbers. But yeah, it has an effect. Washing your hands or using hand sanitizer can give you a modest protective effect. Is it worth, given that's the best we can do, is sort of keep our hands clean, is it worth the sort of social punishment we inflict on people to, be complaining behind someone's back, oh, I can't believe Bill came into the office, look at him, he's sneezing. I mean, that's the sort of thing that I encountered in the office on a regular basis during flu season. I don't know if everyone else has had that experience, but certainly was the case for me.
We're talking to science journalist Daniel Engber about why people come into work when they're sick, why they stay home, and why we judge them one way or the other. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you judge or judge not that sick coworker who shows up? Do you worry about them getting you sick? Do you complain to them or behind their backs? Or have you been on the receiving end? You came in, maybe you shouldn't have, and people gripe to you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We are in the middle of another cold and flu season, and we're talking about the great debate, should you come into the office when you're sick? Should you judge your coworkers for skipping out because they're sick or for showing up, possibly putting you at risk? Call with your thoughts and experiences at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We have Daniel Engber with us. He wrote about this for the New York Times. He's a science journalist, contributing editor at Popular Science and Slate. And Daniel, before we go to our callers, you also write something along the lines of, what does it say about our work culture, our economic setup here, that we feel so much pressure to go to work when we're sick?
Yeah, I think that is the really pernicious thing about this. When someone comes into work sick, sometimes we're frustrated. That person's just trying to, get some extra credit, and by doing so is putting us all, the rest of us, at risk. What does that say? It says that the rest of us are so worried about our own time spent in the office. And I think both of these attitudes, the person who's coming in when he probably should be at home convalescing, and the rest of us being so judgmental, are symptomatic of, kind of a workaholic attitude. And the evidence there is very clear. Americans are working longer hours, crazier hours than people in other countries in the developed world, and I don't think that's a good thing necessarily. I think it's a problem, and it's a difficult problem to solve, because if anyone tries to slow down and take it easy, that person will pay the price because everyone else is pushing so hard.
Well, let's go to our callers. We've got Jerry on the line and Nina. Jerry, hi.
Oh, hi.
What do you think about this?
Well, I think that it depends on whether someone's going to cover your work while you're gone. If you're on a type of job where somebody just covers your work while you're gone, you're more inclined to stay home. If your work is not covered while you're gone and you're building up a backlog, and sometimes it can build to a point where you can't get back on top of it, you're more apt to come in.
Jerry, thanks a lot for that call. It's an interesting point. If you take that sick day when you're on the borderline, you're just making life more difficult for you when you do come back, Daniel.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, there's all kinds of different issues that come into play here. I mean, some people might feel that, you know, their job would be in jeopardy if they started staying home every time they felt a little sick. And I think the burden there is really on the employer to create an environment where people are able to take time off when they need it.
Jerry, thanks for that call. We'll go to Becky in Wind Lake now. Becky, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that at my job, we're able to rack up sick time, and it carries over from year to year. And I work in an office with just a few other people, and I know that they have come to work sick and directly gotten me sick, which then forces me to have to use sick time that I'm trying to save up and rack if I, you know, come ill myself and need 3 days off. So I do find myself, unfortunately, judging other people because they're getting me sick when I typically come to work otherwise healthy.
All right, Becky, but have you ever been on the borderline and decided, I'm going to come in sick, save that sick time for when I really need it?
To be honest, I have, yes, I have. But if I'm sick enough where I'm sneezing, coughing, sinus infections, sweating with a fever, I'm staying home because I do not only want to take care of myself, I don't want to get other people ill.
Becky, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your experience. And this, Daniel, I mean, her, what she's thinking, that's what you're seeing in probably a lot of offices around the country.
Yeah, I think that anger, I mean, it makes sense, of course. What she said is totally, it's reasonable. She doesn't want to have to use up her sick time unnecessarily. She doesn't want to be sick unnecessarily. No one wants that. But I think that the trick, as you point out, is, you know, what are the standards you apply to yourself? What are the standards you apply to others? Naturally, we think we're a lot better at judging our own level of health and how contagious we might be, and we tend to be pretty suspicious of other people, that other people are not making the same wise judgments we would make ourselves.
You know, one pressure we haven't really gotten into is, in some cases, people have no sick leave, no sick time, so if they don't go to work, they make zero money that day. How big a part of the problem is that, do you think?
I think that is a problem. There's there was a recent study of in Canada that found that workers are taking 20% fewer sick days now than they did in 2007. There are similar numbers in the U.S. New employees are getting fewer sick days from employers than they used to, although long-time employees are getting more sick days, so the numbers go both ways. But I think there are these genuine issues here about how much sick time people actually have, whether they could take the time off even if they were willing to.
Back to our callers now. We've got Jen on the line in Oak Creek. Jen, hi.
Hi. I know that this isn't possible for all jobs, but one thing my company does is allow you to work from home. So if you're sick that day, but you still have, you know, a tight deadline, or you're sick, but you're well enough to do work, we actually allow you to work from home, which I think is really nice. I actually did that today.
Jen, well, I hope you feel better. Thanks a lot for calling. Daniel, I could see mixed feelings about that. Okay, you have the opportunity to work, not go in, not expose other people. But I don't know, sometimes when you're sick, don't you want to just go home and be sick?
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, if this working from home thing takes off, then maybe people lose their sick days altogether. They'll just be expected to work wherever they are. But generally speaking, it seems like, it's something I like. Let's say I went into the office and I saw someone who was really, really sick and just coughing all over the place, and it made me so nervous that even, you know, washing my hands over and over again, I still felt like I was going to get sick. Well, maybe I could just go home, work from home for the rest of the day, just to calm my nerves.
Jen, thanks for that. And again, hope you feel better. John is with us now in Racine. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, John?
What do I think? There are places that no matter what you do, if you call in sick, you're penalized for it. Even if you have a doctor's excuse, it's an occurrence you have. And if you get more than five in a year, you know, then they do disciplinary on you.
John, thanks for that call. And Daniel, we were talking about, and you mentioned hoping that employers can change workplace culture. That would be one thing that I think you would be worried about, this disincentive to take that sick day.
Yeah, there's been some research that's trying to show that, you know, when workers come in sick today, that'll just make their health worse overall and they'll be less productive down the line. If that research panned out, it would be really nice because it might go towards convincing employers that it's really in their best interest to let people go home and recover when they're sick. The problem is that research hasn't really panned out so far as I can tell. There isn't a ton of evidence that that people being, you know, what they call presentees actually leads them to be less productive down the line. So I guess that's something that labor economists and business experts are looking into. I'm not sure how it'll turn out.
Well, turning away from the employer side and getting back to the starting point, the peer culture here, how would you like us to think about our sick coworkers in the future and change the judginess we've been talking about?
I just think that you know, we could all relax a little about this, about both coming into work while sick and just this general drive to be as productive as possible at all times. Again, that's the same thing that leads someone to come into work while sick. It's the same thing that leads the rest of us to be so frustrated, worrying that we're going to end up staying home. Maybe we could all just say, you know what, let's take it easy. When we're sick, we stay home. It's no big deal.
Now, own up. In your office life, were you ever one of the judges, looking down on someone showing up too sick?
If I could
put you on the spot.
I tried very hard not to be judgy. I sometimes would get a little agitated and pull out the bottle of Purell and start squirting myself with a hand sanitizer.
All right, Daniel, thanks so much for joining us. Very, very interesting conversation to have.
Okay, thank you very much.
We've been talking to Daniel Engber. He's a science journalist and a contributing editor at both Popular Science and Slate. We've been talking about a piece he wrote on workplace culture surrounding when we show up sick at work. You can let us know your thoughts. Let us know the state of affairs in your office. Tweet us. How about that? Tweet us at Central Time WPR.